So this passage is, for me, simultaneously inspiring and exhausting. It is inspiring in the way that a pep talk can be. Paul's rapid-fire exhortations build a momentum that lifts your heart and points you with confidence towards a specific vision. And the vision here is one of love. In verse 9, agape love, unconditional and enduring, the kind that God has for us. In verse 10, phileo, or family love for those living in community with you. Love for those outside of your family, love for those outside of your community and outside of your station. Love for those who are hard to love, for those who have wronged you, and leaving room always for God's mercy. The text is also exhausting. Just clock the verbs that Paul uses here. Hold fast, outdo, be ardent, do not lag in zeal, persevere. What Paul is asking of this church in Rome is a tall order, and by the way, he's not met them yet. He's introducing himself here in order to win their support for his westward-moving missionary work, and also to warn them against smooth talkers preaching a false gospel that he's nervous will get there before he does. I think at its worst, the exhortations can breed a kind of do-gooderiness, a sanctimonious defense against the world. It can breed a sickness of scruples, exhausting self-criticism and self-consciousness that ultimately ends up centering the self, much the opposite, I think, of what Paul is encouraging us to do here. I don't subscribe to the idea that humans are inherently selfish or evil or totally depraved. Still, the question I am left with at the end of the passage is how? How in the world does a human being approach the practice of love and seemingly inhuman goodness that this text exhorts us to? I learn best by example, and I love biographies, so this evening I want to talk about two historical figures in the church, one very much in it, and one who was decidedly outside of it to get at this how. Much like the text, these two women simultaneously inspire and exhaust me. So the first figure that came to mind in meditating on this text is Saint Therese of Lisieux. She's a goofy character in the history of the church who is posthumously much loved and venerated for the deceptively simple ideas outlined in her spiritual autobiography, Story of a Soul. 28 years after her death, she was sainted, and in the late 90s, she was designated a doctor of the church. She was a big influence on Dorothy Day and Thomas Merton. She was born in 1873 in Alençon, France, to a devout Christian family. She first felt a pull to join the monastery and wholly devote her life to the church at 9 years old, and by 14, the call had become very insistent. She even petitioned the Pope at the time, with her ailing father's blessing, to get a special dispensation to enter monastic life early. And she did at the age of 15. I think the minimum then was about 16. She joined a cloistered Carmelite order in the town of Lisieux, France. So while at the convent, she struggled with her vocation. She felt that she didn't have any particular skill or talent to offer to the world. She was confronted by the realization of her own smallness, and she was restless. In her spiritual autobiography, she writes, "I feel within me other vocations. I feel the vocation of the warrior, the priest, the apostle, the doctor, the martyr. I feel the need and desire of carrying out the most heroic acts for you." In the midst of her confusion regarding her particular vocation, she had a moment of clarity that would come to define the rest of her life. She realizes that if the body of the church was composed of many parts with different functions, then the church must have a heart, and that the function of this heart was love. The church could and would not function without this heart. So while heroic acts felt out of reach for her, love was a science and a practice that she could apply herself to daily. She writes, in all caps, she goes all caps when she gets excited, "Love comprises all vocations. Love is everything. In the heart of the church, I shall be love." But what did this actually look like? What it looked like was something that, from all external experiences, was completely unremarkable, to the point that when Therese died at the young age of 24, a fellow sister worried that there would not be enough to say at her funeral. Therese's how to be love, has come to be known as the little way. And here's an anecdote that illustrates Therese's little way to love. So she's at evening meditation when she finds herself in front of a sister who, quote, "had a strange habit of making a strange little noise which resembled the noise one would make when rubbing two shells one against the other. I was the only one to notice it because I had extremely sensitive hearing. This little noise wearied me. I had a great desire to turn my head and stare at the culprit who was unaware of her click." She continues, "I remained calm, therefore, and tried to unite myself to God and forget the little noise. Everything was useless. I felt the perspiration inundate me. I searched for a way of listening to the noise without annoyance and with peace and joy, at least in the interior of my soul. I tried to love the little noise, which was so displeasing, instead of trying to not hear it, impossible. I paid close attention so as to hear it well, as though it were a delightful concert, and my prayer was spent offering this concert to Jesus. This example is so goofily relatable, as are other similar examples of this kind of micro-trial that Therese really fleshes out in Story of a Soul. Dealing people who eat loudly or ungraciously, and as an aside, I think it's fair to say that she had misophonia, and I want to affirm that that is very real. Another example was dealing with the frustration that comes up when people take your ideas and share them with others as if they were their own. Therese acknowledged, and in my modern day therapy speak, really sat with her discomfort. The discomforts that can come with being in community, the discomforts of decentering the self, and offered that discomfort to God, often in prayer. Therese's how, I venture, was not to deny these micro trials in her day-to-day interaction with her sisters, but to acknowledge them and offer each of them to God. Each of them presented little opportunities to recommit to loving the community that she had pledged her life to. She compared these opportunities to strewing flowers around the throne of God, and she has fittingly come to be known as the Little Flower. The other historical figure that came to mind in reading this passage was Simone Weil. She is similarly a rather intense and goofy character, loved by thinkers from T.S. Eliot to Camus to Iris Murdoch. She was born in 1909, also in France, to a secular Jewish family. At a young age, she threw herself into political activism, sneaking out of the house at 10 years old to join a march of striking workers on the streets of Paris. After attending university, where she studied philosophy, she was assigned to various teaching posts around the country. She felt strongly that philosophy was not just something that you think, talk, read, or write about. It is something that you live. She really wanted to put her body on the line, and she did so, always earnestly, often clumsily, as an organizer, factory laborer, and farmer, among other pursuits. Even her critics had to give admiration for her absolute effort to become excruciatingly identical with her ideas. In her young adulthood, she began to have a series of mystical experiences, specifically with Christ, through song, architecture, and the recitation of a poem by George Herbert, who was a poet and an English clergyman, that drew her to Catholicism, though she would remain decidedly outside of the church during her lifetime, refusing baptism. She was a prolific writer, and during her lifetime, she was known for her political writings, but her spiritual writings were private and only published after her death by some close and trusted friends that she gave her manuscripts to. One of her essays, Attention and Will, in the collection Gravity and Grace, I think offers a very vain explication of Romans 12. She says, "It is not by force of will that we cure our faults or approach kindness and goodness." She continues, "We have to try to cure our faults by attention and not by will. What could be more stupid than to tighten up our muscles and set our jaws about virtue or poetry or the solution of a problem? Attention is quite different." In her philosophy, attention was something very specific. Paying attention involved a process of decreating, decentering, or emptying yourself. She was always one for drawing paradoxes, and she says that decreation is what God had to do in order to create the world. God had to retreat, empty, retire, fold in on himself in order to create space for the world and make space for the other. Iris Murdoch called it unselfing and putting aside the fat, relentless ego in order to create a sort of vacancy that allows you to wait on, attend to, and love others, to see others as they relate to themselves rather than as they might relate to you. At work this week, I was listening to a friend, and all the while I was acutely aware that I also very much looked like I was listening. Squatting on the ground, so we were at eye level, my chin was cupped in my hand, my body language screamed active listening, and I was, but there was never quite a forgetting of the self. There is always an awareness of, I need to signal to my friend, and to passersby for that matter, that I'm listening. There was a desire to kind of, there was an awareness of a sort of social currency that was being exchanged in that interaction. And I don't bring up this example out of self-criticism or because I think it was particularly bad or wrong. Body language and self-awareness are important. It just strikes me how hard that kind of abandon and attention can be. fittingly, I think Simone Weil says attention is the rarest and purest form of generosity. She continues, and this is one of her more famous quotes from this essay, "The poet produces the beautiful by fixing his attention on something real. It is the same with the act of love. To know that this man who is hungry and thirsty really exists as much as I do, that is enough. The rest follows itself." I work in a hospital in an inpatient psychiatric unit, and we have some patients who have been with us for a very long time, mostly because there is nowhere in society that they can quite return to. It's often difficult to find nursing facilities or rehab centers or group homes to discharge them to because of terrible stigma against people living with chronic serious mental illness combined with the sheer complexity of their medical needs. There's one man in particular who has been with us for the past 6 months and will probably be with us for the next 6 months. He is quite remarkable in his capacity for insults. His slights are so specific and creative, it's pretty impressive. And over time with the verbal abuse, it is easy to forget that his hunger, thirst, and pain is just as real as any of us staff members, that his life is just as real as mine, that his desire for an orange soda is as real as my desire for another cup of coffee. He will sometimes say, "Why is my life full of suffering?" And it's true, his life is full of suffering, physical, social, psychological, in a way I can't really imagine. He's been in a nursing home since he was 30 years old. Crudely put, I think Simone would proffer that to attend to him, to really know that his hunger and thirst really exists, that is enough and the rest will follow. Therese and Simone had a lot in common, including mystical visitations from Christ, early callings into a life of service to others, a neurotic drive for inner purity. They were also both ill for much of their lives, and they both died very young, both of tuberculosis, Therese at 24, Simone at 34, and their spiritual writings were discovered and popularized posthumously. I don't intend to share their ideas prescriptively. In particular, I do think they both offer interesting insights and inspirations to the practice of love that Paul exhorts us to. Saint Therese through her little way and Simone with her practice of attention. What I want to end on, though, is their recognition that the practices of love they describe aren't born out of sheer strength of will or personal strivings. Though a sanctimonious child, as Therese grows older, she lets her defenses down, offers her limitations to God, and says, "Now abandonment alone guides me. I have no other compass." Similarly, Simone writes about creating the conditions internally to let grace in. Action is the needle that shows the balance. We must not touch the needle, but the weight. We share the sermon here at St. Lydia's. We'll spend a few moments in silent reflection. Then, when you hear the bell sound, you're invited to share a story or experience that was sparked by the sermon or text. We share stories, not opinions, because Jesus told stories, and stories help us to know one another better. We begin in silence.